On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The Baltimore City Council is about to undergo a momentous transformation. In December, more than half of the 14 seats on the council will be occupied by first-time legislators, with the likely prospect that the mayor will be occupying an executive position for the first time in her political career. What does that mean for the future of Charm City? Jane Miller is an award-winning investigative reporter for WBAL Television. Luke Broadwater covers the city for the Baltimore Sun. And Kenneth Burns is the Metro reporter covering Baltimore for WIPR. They join me in the studio for a breakdown of the council races and some prognostication as to how this large class of newbies will get along with veteran council president Jack Young and their more seasoned council colleagues. First, the news. And happy Halloween, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. I hope you are in costume. So here's a thought to ponder that some may find kind of scary as we prepare to celebrate All Hallows' Eve. The Baltimore City Council will surely be transformed after the election next week. We know that Baltimore will have a new mayor come December. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake did not seek re-election. The frontrunner in that race is long on legislative experience on the council, in the House of Delegates, and in the Maryland Senate. But Catherine Pugh has had no political executive experience, and the changes in the makeup of the city council will be dramatic. Six city council incumbents decided not to run in the primary last April. Robert Curran, Rochelle Ricky Spector, and Helen Holton are retiring for various reasons. Nick Mosby and Carl Stokes chose to run for mayor instead of for their council seats. James Kraft ran for Baltimore Circuit Court judge. So two other city council incumbents, William Pete Welch in the 9th District and Warren Branch in the 13th, were unseated in the primary by fellow Democrats. So that means that no matter what happens on Election Day, at least 8 of the 14 seats on the city council will be occupied by first-time legislators. So what does that mean for the future of Charm City? Well, joining me today for a reporter's roundtable are three reporters who follow all things Baltimore very closely. Jane Miller is an award-winning investigative reporter for WBAL Television. Luke Broadwater covers the city for the Baltimore Sun. And Kenneth Burns is the Metro reporter covering Baltimore for WYPR. They join me in the studio for a breakdown of the interesting council races across all 14 districts and perhaps some prognostication as to how this large class of newbies will get along with veteran council president Jack Young if he too wins re-election, which seems pretty likely, and the rest of their council colleagues. You can join us on the phone. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Good to see everybody. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Happy
Good
Halloween.
Afternoon.
So, you know, I talked to folks about the presidential election.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I'm surprised we're not starting off with the, you know, Clinton's private server.
Yeah, with the private server. But people, there's such fatigue about it. You know, I'm reminded of a sign I saw when I ran the Baltimore Half Marathon a couple of years ago. On Eastern Avenue, there's this woman holding up this great sign that says, and here's like 12,000 people running 13 miles going past her. She's got this sign that says, "Worst parade ever." And that's sort of what the presidential campaign has kind of come down to.
Tom, I don't know if I disagree. I think I disagree with that. I think people, yeah, they're kind of eager for it to get over with. But I posted a story on my Facebook page on Saturday morning, written by Kurt Eichenwald from Newsweek about the whole email. And I've had 7,500 views on that. I mean, it's like, whoa.
Oh, it's riveting.
No, so
it's riveting.
That's what I mean.
Sure.
So yeah. I'm not sure that, I think that people
But they're ready
are very,
for it to be over.
Yes, but I think they're also probably in more engaged. You know, the NFL is blaming the presidential election for a drop-off in NFL ratings.
Right.
I blame it on really
down.
Lackluster play. But, yeah. You know, but it's, I really think that people are entrenched, yes, polarized, absolutely, but they're engaged at a very intense level.
More people registered than ever before,
and
200 million voters
numbers.
Nationwide,
yes.
And the early voting numbers would certainly suggest that people
very
are paying
polarized.
Attention.
Yeah, I think we may be seeing a unique trend in that typically people aren't motivated to vote against somebody. It's passion for someone that brings people to the polls. This might be the first election we've really seen where the primary motivator is to vote against the competition. And so that may be why we're seeing.
I mean, there's
these.
Always a certain yeah. amount of that, you know.
Yeah, but this time I think it's much more pronounced.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the question is, and I've posed this to several of the incumbents who've come on the show, is this really a change election? And I was interested in that the narrative was that this was the year for a change election. This is the disruptor year. This is the year that people wanted to really.
It wasn't in Baltimore.
But it wasn't, because the two candidates for mayor who were leading the race for the entire time were Sheila Dixon and Catherine Pugh.
And the likely change candidate, DeRay McKesson, was way, way, way back in the pack and probably learned a lesson that if you're going to run for office, you got to get on TV.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can't do it social media.
You can't do it. That's right.
You have to get on TV, and then you have to remember who your voter is. And I remember listening to another station where he complained about the polling. He said, that's a reflective of an old model. We're looking at new ideas and new energy. And I'm saying to myself, Mr. McKesson, you need to know who your voter is in Baltimore City. And somehow, I don't think he realized that.
That's actually true everywhere. You have to know who your voter is. And,
but speaking of change, we are going to have change, whether we want it or not, on the Baltimore City Council. Whoever wins the election, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green Party, 8 of the 14 will be brand new. And only a few have really experience, like a couple of our aides to current council members. One or two have law degrees, but many of them are brand new to politics.
And young.
They're all new, young. And some of them are quite gifted, I think.
I think it's great.
I think it's terrific.
Oh, no, I think the best thing about the whole election in Baltimore, even though the top of the ticket is an established politician, been around a long time in politics, being on the Democratic side, that you have this complete new crop of energetic, obviously, leaders. And I think the impact of that can be dramatic. Jack Young is an old-time politician. I'm not saying he's old, because he and I are the same age, I think. but, you know, he comes from the old, you know, kind of Democratic Club type of background. And these folks don't. And I think it's going to be like wrestling cats for Jack.
This is really going to be interesting to watch.
This is going to be a lot of fun to watch.
And so one of the two things could happen. They could overrun him. You know,
you
can only herd so many cats so many times.
They can form their own block.
Or
he
can, you know, whack them into line.
Kevin Plank has got to be the happiest guy on the planet.
And why?
Because he got his TIF through.
Sure. Because in addition to this group being younger and perhaps more engaged, they also, I think, skew more progressive.
And independent.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're going to see things like the $15 minimum wage have a much better chance, and you're going to see things like TIFs for big business have a much weaker chance of passing, I think.
Yeah, so Kevin Plank's happy because had this TIF not passed and had gone to the next council, he would
have
had
a
lot
of
less chance.
It's exactly right. But I do think, to Luke's point, too, about like TIFs, et cetera, you know, there was a lot of discussion during the mayor's race that, you know, the way to deal with a big developer is to say, okay, we'll do this for you, but we need to get this from you in return. Now, they got this community benefits agreement, but I think what this crop of council people will be talking about will be a much greater prize for the city if, you know, the developer wants to do a deal like that. I just think it's going to be really fascinating to watch. This is beyond my experience in Baltimore, is to have this kind of influx of new people on the city council all at once.
Yeah, hasn't transformed this much since like 2003, and you could even make the
before that I've been here much longer than that.
Something,
oh yeah,
you know?
Oh no, yeah. That's what I mean. This goes way back.
And
that's right.
Kenny, remind us, Council President Young tried and failed in a bill to usurp some of the mayoral power back to himself and people on the Board of Estimates. It came close, but so the new mayor won't have to deal with it, but refresh our memories on
that. Yes, he tried to shave the Board of Estimates. Right now you have 5 people, City Council President, Comptroller Joan Pratt, well, Joan Pratt for the moment, and then in addition to the mayor, you have 2 of her appointees, the City Solicitor and the Board of Public Works. It did not pass. Well, it passed. She vetoed it, but he did not have
Mayor Rawlings Blake.
Mayor Rawlings Blake. And there wasn't enough votes to, or at least enough of a will to override the veto. He was really disappointed by that.
Yeah. And Catherine Pugh is against that also. So if they try it again, it could set up another fight between the council and the mayor.
Yeah, and another veto, perhaps. Yeah, who knows? I mean, but it'll be interesting to see how, for example, this new crop of young people.
Well, looking down the road is that, I mean, I don't know what Catherine Pugh should she be elected in November. I don't know what her plan is, you know, looking down. But out of that crop of eight, there's probably a couple of mayoral candidates in there not Absolutely. Too long down the road.
Yeah, and, or out of the crop of the six who were returning. I mean, I think about a kid like Brandon Scott.
Yes, yes. Correct.
Who is a rising star.
Yeah, you forget. I mean, there's a young guy. Yeah.
He's a young guy.
And he's very connected to the new.
Yes.
That's what I mean.
You could see him emerge as sort of a leader of that new group of Democrats on the council and maybe even challenge Jack Young as sort of their own sect on the council. And for power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I shouldn't refer to Councilman Scott as a kid, but when you get to be, when you get to be my age, sometimes they start looking like kids.
Right.
30s qualifies. Sorry, kid.
I'm really looking at how these roles will play out overall, because right now you have Councilwoman Spector, who's kind of like the dean. Will that role pass along to Councilwoman Mary Pat Clark? You have, of course, the new block of young, more progressive councilors. It's going to be really interesting, especially when we start getting to January and February, where the new council really starts to make their legislation.
Yeah. So, Luke, you had a piece that was in the hard copy of the paper over the weekend. Let's talk about District 12.
Sure.
It's on the east side. It's downtown. It's sort of north of North Avenue. The incumbent Democrat is Carl Stokes, who decided to run for mayor. And Robert Stokes is the Democrat who won the primary, hotly contested. But there is no relation, but that's going to confuse people, I mean, probably. So Robert Stokes, not related to Carl Stokes. He's actually third in campaign cash, as you have reported, in this race against two other folks. Tell us about these two others.
Yeah, that's a pretty unique race. I mean, typically in Baltimore, the elections are over in the primary. I mean, practically speaking, Democrats have all the inherent advantages. But in this case, we saw a Democrat win in a crowded field with only 33% of the Democratic primary support behind him. And now you have a Green Party candidate and an independent who have out-fundraised him during the general election. And all evidence I can see is that they've knocked on a ton more doors than he has. They've been much more active in going to community association meetings. And so they're working for it. Will that matter? I don't know. I mean, will people just see the name Stokes and vote for it thinking it's Carl? Do they know Robert Stokes? Does he have a track record there? But it seems like that, if you're going to pinpoint certain council races, that's one you can look to in the general election as actually mattering.
Now, it turns out Robert Stokes is 57 years old, and he serves as a legislative aide to Carl Stokes. So he's one of the two people on the ballot, these new candidates, who do have some actual city council experience, although not as legislators themselves. So he does have a little experience. But in an election like this, Kenny, I mean, are people even going to be hip to the fact that he's got some legislative experience?
See, that's the question. I mean, you take your low information voter, they look at the ballot, they might just see Stokes and think, oh, well, Carl found a way to get back into the city council race and vote for him based on the name. But even during the primary, Robert Stokes didn't seem all that active. I mean, he showed up to forums. He got his name out. In fact, I bumped into him at the League of People with Disabilities Friday. But I'm wondering if his ground game is as organized as the other two candidates.
And Luke, what can you tell us about Ian Schlockman, who is the Green Party candidate, or Frank Richardson, who's unaffiliated, and there's another guy named Dan Sparacco,
sure.
Also an unaffiliated candidate.
So Ian Schlockman is a very, very progressive candidate. He's part of the Green Party. He calls himself a socialist. He's proposing really vast, widespread changes that he thinks are needed in Baltimore. Everything from creating our own solar energy, I don't know if the right word is plant, but system, where we would rely on that instead of BGE for our energy. Then you have Dan Sparacco, who petitioned to get on the ballot. He actually filed a lawsuit against the State Board of Elections to get him on the ballot. The other two candidates
fought
that.
And his suit contended that the February deadline was unfair. It was too far in advance of the election.
That's correct.
And he won. He got on.
Yes. And so now he's on the ballot. If he wins, he'd be the only lawyer on the council. We have no lawyers right now with Jim Kraft departing. He sees that as a big advantage. He used to work in the city's law department and thinks he knows enough about it to reform city government from within. Frank Richardson sees himself as the most authentic candidate in the race. He's from Baltimore originally. He's really in touch with the people in the neighborhoods. He's a longtime worker for the Build organization, so he has a lot of grassroots support as well. I think it's kind of an exciting race there in that district that sort of spans east and a little bit of west, the West Side.
And Mr. Stokes won with 33% of the vote. He was in a field of seven candidates. I mean, it was, you know, so he didn't by any means get the majority of Democrats even in that race.
Yeah,
it was a tight one with Kelly Cross.
Yeah, Kelly Cross. It was a matter of hundreds of votes, right? It was very, very close.
I think it was 300, 400.
Yeah,
about 300 votes.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we will take your phone calls when we come back. Jane Miller is the lead investigative reporter for WBAL Television's I-Team. Luke Broadwater is an award-winning Metro reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Kenneth Burns has also won a whole bunch of awards. He covers Baltimore for WYPR. We will have more analysis of the Baltimore City Council races after a quick break. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Stick around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're spending part of your day with us. We appreciate it. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the Worldwide Broadcast, a conversation about police training and de-escalation tactics. How are the police trained to interact with citizens in situations like the tragic incident involving Corinne Gaines, who was killed by police in Baltimore County after an hours-long standoff? What are the policies concerning use of force, and what de-escalation strategies have been found to be effective? That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday at noon here on 88.1. If you're just joining us today, my guests are three great observers of Baltimore city politics. Jane Miller is WBAL-TV's lead investigative reporter. Luke Broadwater is a Metro reporter for the Baltimore Sun. And Kenneth Burns covers Baltimore right here at WYPR. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. So, Jane, let's talk about your neighborhood, the first district. Yeah, the first district, which includes.
So, I'm getting all those flyers.
Yeah.
Correct.
You're getting a whole lot of flyers for two really interesting candidates. This is the area that includes Little Italy, Fells Point, Canton, you know, Harbor East, that kind of stuff. Zeke Cohen, who ran in a highly contested Democratic primary against five other people, prevailed in that contest with just 27% of the vote. But he's been campaigning for a long time. He's running against a very interesting young man, a guy named Matt McDaniel, who carried 51% in the primary against two other Republicans. You know, there were folks speculating that because Larry Hogan, for the first time, prevailed in that district, in that city council district. First time a Republican has prevailed in any city council district in 2014, when he was elected governor. Does Matt McDaniel have a chance as a Republican candidate for the city council?
It's interesting because in the flyers, you know, this is that season where you get all those flyers in the mail, and Matt McDaniel's flyer has him pictured with Larry Hogan, like that Larry Hogan endorsed. Kathy Schlage is trying to do that too. Hogan endorsed stamp of approval. It is, you know, during the primary, that was a very competitive primary on both sides, both on the Republican side and, you know, that was full of really qualified candidates running, no question. That's true of a number of the districts in Baltimore. That was really a good sign this year. I think that, is it competitive? Sure, it's competitive. You do have a district that did vote Republican in the 2014 gubernatorial election. Zeke Cohen has been running, you're right, for a long time, no question, as the Democrat. McDaniel is trying to capitalize on his, you know, endorsement from Hogan, and also trying to, he's really concentrating on the public safety issue. I think that's his main. He's got some.
And that's been somewhat controversial. I mean, when they were
correct.
On, because I had Zeke and Matt on the show to talk about issues affecting the first, and we had a few callers not pleased about.
Well, during the McDaniel's, forum, I did the Canada Forum for the Canton Community Association back in September, I think it was, with them, and it was very interesting. I mean, they're very different in. Matt's got this idea of, I was really trying to get him to be more specific about what he's talking about checking ingress and egress points into Southeast Baltimore, you know, suggesting that people are coming into the district to commit crime, And yes, it,
yeah,
it has raised...
talking about using cameras and even posted police officers asking why you're coming into the First District.
That's correct. Like checkpoints. That's what I said. You mean like checkpoints?
Yeah. I mean, that kind of sounds like that. He didn't characterize them as that when he was here, but it does kind of sound like
I asked him about that, and he described it more as... a way to catch people after crimes had been committed than as a way to prevent people from entering the district. So in other words, if a car was broken into, they could then look at the camera later and see, oh, that's where this guy went, and try to follow him or whatever. He explained it to me as being a retroactive, not a proactive
and
crime
after the
fighting
fact thing.
Technique.
Yeah.
He's also interested in property taxes. He literally told me he opened his property tax bill and saw it was doubled than anywhere else in the state of Maryland. He wants to lower that. He also wants to expand prosperity to the rest of the city. I asked him about the Tale of Two Districts because keep in mind, you have Canton, you have Fells Point, basically all these vibrant waterfront neighborhoods. But then you go a little bit further east, you have O'Donnell Heights, you have Browning Highway and St. Helena, where all the factory workers used to live, and it's not really that vibrant over there if you even drive around. So I asked him, do you believe in this, that the First District is kind of like a tale of two districts? He said, no, it's more like Baltimore and a tale of 30 cities where you have each different neighborhood that's unique.
Yeah, there's a vast difference between the most prosperous and the least prosperous people in the First District. But this is... as you said, Jane, a heartening sign, because we had really good candidates on both sides of this race and many others. I think of Liz Copeland.
Yes, correct. Who was one of the candidates in that race.
She was a candidate running against McDaniel, didn't win the race. She's been here on Midday as an analyst on the Republican side. She founded a thing called the Urban Conservative Project. She's a very thoughtful, very smart person, and you know, very engaged.
One of the Democratic candidates
in
the race that didn't win told me that what was really encouraging to him is that when he knocked on doors, people in the district said, well, I'm really interested in what your ideas are for the whole city.
Not just the district.
Correct. Right. And I think that's where, so if you have a voter who is looking kind of globally at the city of Baltimore, and if you have a candidate who's looking inwardly at the district, there may be some pushback to that. I don't know. We're going to see, you know, by the time we get to November 8th. But the other thing about the district is, if you look at, as you were talking about, Kenny, as you get the further southeast, that's also, though, where Amazon is now located. That's also where there's more, you know, warehouse development going on because of Amazon. There's a, you know, Bayview has expanded. It's a district that is really developing and fast. Canton Crossing is obviously very successful. So in terms of a lower income resident, as long as they can continue to live there, I mean, there is more opportunity for people that don't have a car, et cetera, in that particular district. And I think that's the challenge that you want to see everywhere. You want to see that in every quarter of the city, is to have that kind of opportunity.
And to have more people... And to have more people caring about the whole city instead of just what's happening
exactly
on the
right
block.
It was really interesting to me to hear them say that
I would say that's a dividing line between the two candidates in the first, that Zeke Cohen has repeatedly spoken about how you need to care about all the other districts in Baltimore, that their problems affect you, that their issues affect you. And McDaniel has sort of said, I'm going to focus more on the first district and trying to improve the first. So that's one thing people could point to. And I will say that even though Hogan won this district 2 years ago, the other statewide Democrats easily won it. So it may be more of a Hogan anomaly. And if you look at the fundamentals in the race, you have much, much more fundraising for Zeke Cohen. And he was running for longer than Matt McDaniel. So.
And just to add to that, about talking about Hogan, I think the Democrats in this state are going to be very eager to see this result in November, to see what happens to a Kathy Shalega, does she, you know, does she beat Van Hollen? Does she get close?
She's running for U.S. Senate.
Right.
You know, exactly. And she's Hogan endorsed, as we see on all her signs.
Exactly right. Yeah. In the first district. In other words, to kind of test that.
Yeah.
Are we
yeah.
dealing with
was
this
it a
kind
Hogan
of,
thing? Or
right.
was it a,
is this state getting redder? Yeah, or is this a phenomena of an individual Republican candidate?
Yeah. Now, but the problem, though, is that Hogan's not actually on the ballots.
Correct.
And Donald
right.
Trump is on the ballot.
Right.
So it's the Trump
it's
coattails,
like,
which I'm not
point.
Sure
right.
necessarily helps McDaniel or Shalega in Maryland.
Probably not.
And McDaniel hasn't yet to answer because we've asked him.
Right. Well, he will not,
he
will not utter the T word.
I asked him about Trump. He said, well, he didn't endorse me. I'm not endorsing him. So it's and Malia Cromer from Goucher College said this perfectly. You need a stronger declaration against Trump this year. As we have all learned, either you have to come out and say Trump is an idiot, I don't like him, or I think Trump is the greatest thing, but there is no room for in between this year.
We have an emailer who's laughing in a tweet. Actually, laughing at me, saying, ha, 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 Tom Hall calling out Councilman Brandon Scott as a likely mayoral candidate in 4 years before the general election is even done. Well, guilty as charged. Mea culpa
maxima. That must be
somebody
who wants to run against him.
That's right. Mm. Let's go to the phones. Dale from Greenmount West, welcome to Midday with Jane Miller, Kenny Burns, and Luke Broadwater. Glad you called.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for getting me on. I'm really happy with the slate of candidates throughout the city. I live in the 12th District, and as I was saying to your screener, it's a great problem to have. You have Dan and Frank and Robert Stokes and a lot of other good candidates, and even though I'm going to be supporting a Democratic candidate in 12th District, I'm not going to be supporting a Democratic candidate for mayor. I'm voting green on the mayor's side.
Joshua Harris.
And one thing of having this slate of good candidates, not only in our district, but throughout the city, these good quality candidates, even some of the Republicans that are running, they're not crazy like the party. And what'll happen, hopefully, is it'll break this logjam of some of these Democrats thinking that the primary is over. That's one of the main reasons I'm not supporting Captain Pugh, is because he hasn't run a campaign since April. She's still running the same she's still running the same ad she ran back in April.
Yeah, but you know what? At least she's back on TV. I did a story last week saying, hey, wait a minute.
That's a key thing.
This mayor's race has life, you know?
Yeah,
no,
usually,
really.
Usually the mayoral candidates don't need or they don't
Correct.
See a
it's like
reason
you never see,
right.
hear
to
from
put
them
anything
again.
On
That's
television
right.
or
right.
to do anything. Dale, you're exactly right.
But you're right. They're the same as she ran in the primary. Correct. Yeah. And she does have some money.
But Dale, you've got a great bumper sticker there. You know, put in name of candidate. Not crazy. So stick that right on the back of your car.
I don't think Stephanie Rawlings Blake in 2011 ran a television ad after the primary.
Yeah, most don't. Yeah. Most don't. Well, Dale, thank you for your call, and you're exactly right. We were just saying, you know, that it's really a good sign for the body politic and for the future of Baltimore politics that we do have young, engaged, intellectually curious, imaginative people running for office. I think
even some of the people that lost, I think, have made quite a name for themselves and can come back.
Absolutely.
You look at a DeRay McKesson, you look at a Calvin Young.
Mark Adelson.
Mm-hmm. Joshua
I'm going to forget people, not mentioning them all. But
Elizabeth
yes.
Embry running for the mayor.
Correct. I expect to see her in something.
Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Correct.
Let's talk about the third district. That's in Northeast Baltimore, places like Lauraville and Herring Run Park. Robert Curran.
This is the Bob Curran district.
He's
right.
the current council person retiring for health reason. The Democrat in that race, Ryan Dorsey, again, crowded field in his primary, but running against a person named Spilly Spiliotis, who's a Green Party candidate, Luke Broadwater. This is another instance where it's not just necessarily a cut and dry thing between a Democrat and a Republican who is, you know, very much unfavored.
Yes.
No Republican's ever been favored.
The race here is between, is all on the left, so to speak. I mean, it's the Democrat versus the Green Party. So now from, I don't live in the Northeast, but from people I know that live up there, there are a lot of yard signs for Spilly. He doesn't have the money of Dorsey, but he seems to be well-liked and well-known in the community. He's really getting around, knocking on doors. People have said they met him. So I think he is running an active campaign. And I know that the Democrats are taking him seriously because on a day when I was shadowing Catherine Pugh, they had a fundraiser for Ryan Dorsey where she was making calls on his behalf, and they're viewing that as a race they really are trying to win. So I think if you're looking at a handful of races, that's one to pay attention to in Baltimore.
Is it me, or is the Green Party enjoying a higher profile in this cycle here locally?
It's not you.
locally or than before. I mean, because it seems to me that the Green Party candidates are just better known and making a bigger impact on the issues that are being talked about and the way the races are coming down.
It's not you. And one thing I'm picking up, particularly in the mayor's race, the supporters of Joshua Harris, they're kind of tired of the machine politic. They weren't going to vote for Senator Pugh during the primary if they were registered Democrats, but Sheila lost. And so some of them, they were going to go
Sheila
behind
Dixon.
Sheila
yeah.
Dixon. Mm-hmm. Some of them were going to go behind back Joshua Harris because he speaks more to the issues they care about compared to Senator Pugh. And I mean, I can't remember a time where I've seen this many Green candidates ever in, well, anywhere that as far as state politics or even when I used to live in the D.C. area.
Jane Miller, the fact that Sheila Dixon decided so late in the game to re-enter the race.
Just talking to somebody about this.
As a write-in candidate. First of all, the rules about being a write-in candidate are somewhat unclear to folks. It was thought when she first announced, and it was even published in a few press reports, that unless the voter wrote her name exactly as it appears,
it's incorrect.
it won't count. But that's not
right.
the case.
That's incorrect. Yeah.
So there's all sorts of ways you could vote for Sheila
Dixon.
Let
me answer that first, because I just asked this question of the State Board of Election. No, the way election law is written is that if you have any abbreviation, a misspelling, any minor alteration of the name, as long as the election board can discern who you intended to. So, I mean, Sheila's name's like mine. You know, you could easily forget the Y in the middle of my name. Sheila's S-H-E-I-L-A.
L-A.
You could easily reverse the I and the E.
Or spelled Dixon, D-I-X-E-N or
whatever.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But if
no.
that, you know.
No, as long as they can reasonably figure out, no, that's what the voter intended.
And if there were another Dixon
yes,
as a writing
then you might
candidate,
have
then
an
it would
issue.
Be,
correct.
There'd be
yes.
an issue. Yeah.
So, yes, there can be minor errors in the writing in of the name. Her biggest, you know, I was just talking to somebody that, you know, is very observant of state politics, that had she gotten on the ballot, and she's not on the ballot as a write-in candidate.
Right.
So you have to go in.
The deadline for that was the 19th of September.
Correct.
And she missed that by weeks.
So on the ballot, there are, you know, the party nominees, and then there's a list of write-in candidates that's provided, like cheat sheet. Like if you want to make a write-in candidate, here's who they are. She's not on that list.
Right.
So she has to totally depend on the voter taking full initiative to go in there and write in that name in that box. But the person I was talking to said, you know, had she launched this campaign sometime over the July, raised a little money, she could have made, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe so still, but
sure.
But that's a lot to ask a voter to, it's less than anybody to go in and properly fill out the form, you
with
know.
With 3 weeks to go, and this has been my point, because they point to Tony Williams, who used to be mayor of D.C. He got booted off the ballot because of improprieties with the nominating petition. He had to change his campaign in midstream to a write-in campaign. It was 3 months before the primary. This happened in July. So he had all summer long to not only get his name out there, but to make sure people spell his name right. In fact, they were passing out, if I recall correctly, rubber stamps so they could just stamp his name on the ballot.
Yeah.
She launched her write-in campaign with 3 weeks to go. That's a lot to pull off, to get the band back together again, get organized again, and then get out there and get your name out and say, hey, I'm still in the race.
Yeah, we're going to take a call before we continue this conversation. Jennifer in Baltimore City, welcome to Midday with Luke Broadwater, Kenny Burns, and Jane Miller. Glad you called.
Hello. Yeah, glad to hear you all talking today. I wanted to take issue a little bit with the kind of toss-off phrase I hear often, even on NPR, that we have two presidential candidates that people are voting against rather than for somebody. I really don't think that's accurate. And to put Hillary Clinton kind of level with Donald Trump as two, you know, it just really irks me, and I'm surprised to hear it. I mean, there are hundreds of Marylanders every weekend going to Pennsylvania to canvass for Hillary Clinton, fully behind her, and not just doing it because they don't like Trump. And so I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. It's just across
sure.
the board, it's troubling.
Sure,
so.
Luke.
So yeah, I made that point earlier. I mean, that is responding to public opinion surveys that show both candidates being upside down on approval ratings and both having more people dislike them than like them. Now, obviously, the point you raise is very valid, which is that Trump's even more disliked than Clinton is. And that, of course, is not to say there are many people who don't really like and are passionate about these people. And clearly from the polls, there are more that feel that way about Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump.
I'll address it, too, because I'm of the age that, you know, we've all, you know, been up against a glass ceiling. And I mean, I know many people, many women who to the same point, they are voting for someone and
because
not
because of the historic nature of this
just,
election.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. And yeah, I would agree. I think that overall there's been this toxic, you know, tone to this. And but I think underneath it, it's, I mean, I see that hashtag I'm with her, mm-hmm. you know, that on Twitter that is pretty popular. And I think it is unfair to kind of lump everybody into a boat of their voting for. And this is true on the Trump side, too. There's, you know, sure. They're not just voting against
right.
Clinton,
yeah.
you know.
You look at those rallies. Those people love Donald
Absolutely.
Trump.
Absolutely, yeah. correct.
Indeed.
That's
well,
exactly
Jennifer,
right.
thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Kenneth Burns is the Metro reporter here at WIPR. Luke Broadwater is the Metro reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Jane Miller is WBAL-TV's lead investigative reporter. We'll have more with these three great folks after we come back for a break. You can give us a call and join the conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
You're tuned to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. If you are just joining us today, it's a Reporters Roundtable on Baltimore politics. Reporters Jane Miller, Luke Broadwater, and Kenneth Burns are my guests today. We are discussing the race. Actually, there are 15 of them, if you count the city council president. We're talking about the Baltimore City Council and the transformation that it will have going forward. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall, or drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. I want to read a couple of tweets. Here's one from Melissa, who says, "I'm another Democrat voting green for mayor. I live in the 12th and I'm disappointed. Robert Stokes, the Democratic candidate in that district, has no website and didn't show for the debates." We have one from a person in Hamilton Hills saying, "It's interesting to see that Ian Schlachman was campaigning besides Democrats in other districts back in the primary." So he's, a Green Party candidate. But Luke, how do you explain that? He's in other districts campaigning with Democrats.
Well, I think he's aligning himself with some of the younger crop of Democrats who are planning to take over the council. Ian Schlachman certainly has to appeal to Democrats if he wants to win that district. He has picked up some endorsements from groups that traditionally endorse Democrats, such as CASA and also the Sierra Club. So,
they work with immigrants, CASA Maryland, right?
Yes. So he is totally doing that outreach, and I can see why he would think that would be a good strategy.
So Jane Miller, we just learned today, that Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, the current mayor, has said that the deadline of November 1st for the consent decree coming out of
the
DOJ report that was issued over the summer will not be met. They will not have, when she referred to that date tomorrow as aspirational. What does this mean for the next mayor and the next city council?
Well, I think she's indicated she's still hopeful that it's going to get done in her term, which is now about 5 weeks off, right?
It's December 6th or something like that.
I don't know what it means. I do think that the next mayor, and to the extent the city council wants to get involved in public safety and oversight and police department oversight, and they probably, you know, there's probably a few of those new candidates or those new council members that are going to think they need to be more active than they have been on that front. But that the issue of policing in Baltimore is going to be a dominant issue. You've got the consent decree. I don't know if this means the police department's kicking and screaming about it. I don't know if it means the DOJ is not happy with the way it's. I don't know what it means. We don't know what it means. But it's going to be a dominant.
I mean,
issue.
Had a number of events, community events.
Yes,
where they're
they
trying
have,
to get
and they may be just trying to. You know, that's correct. I don't know what it means. I know that in other cities that, you know, it's sometimes it's been a struggle to come up with the right terms of it that everybody can agree on, et cetera. I mean, look at, you know.
And sometimes it's trouble to come up with the money that it may cost to implement
whatever. And Baltimore's fully prepared for that it's going to cost money. But you've got that issue. You've got the Fraternal Order of Police contract is still not negotiated. Mm-hmm. There's still no new contract, and they're under the terms of the one that expired. It would be only a one-year contract anyway. So either way, next mayor is going to have to deal with the FOP. And this issue of having more civilian participation in police department oversight is going to be absolutely a continuing issue. And it's obviously the union's very resistant to that. So you've got to, and then just put all of that here for a second. And if Trump wins in November, urban areas, cities are going to have all kinds of hands full, I think, based on what he has said on the campaign trail about law and order issues and policing issues and, you know, declaring
Justice Department might be very, very different than the
Could
Obama
be a
Justice
very,
Department.
That's exactly right.
The Supreme
right.
Court
that's,
will
that's
certainly
right.
be a different.
That's right. There could be all kinds of issues that a mayor of a city like Baltimore has got to deal with. I remember during the Reagan years, and you know that there was it was definitely a different way of doing business for the city of Baltimore with Washington.
Even during the Bush years, when you look Correct. About the people in the voting section of the Civil Rights Department of the Department of Justice, I mean, a very different very different perspective.
But Correct. There's one outlier that we have not brought up at all. Remember, the Baltimore City Police Department is a state agency. So we're a couple of months away from the General Assembly starting their session. Who knows what bills could come up? I think there's one to take the control of the police department out of the hands of the state and under the auspices of the city, or whatever law that they want to propose to try to rein in the police department. You still have that out there. And for right now, we don't have a consent decree to go by right now.
And I'm sure this consent decree was also slowed down, at least slightly, by the turnover at the top of the city solicitor's office. I mean, George Nelson had hired
this law firm.
He was leading the process. Then he gets fired with this very embarrassing incident with the neo-Nazi sympathizer lawyer.
Who had been hired as a contract employee. Right?
And so now he's removed. They have to, David Ralph, who had not been involved in this process intimately, steps into his role, and that's got to slow things down.
And the solicitor is a mayoral appointee, so who's to say that David Ralph might even still have the job after December?
Right. Very Let's true. Talk about a couple of other districts. We're not going to get to all 14, obviously, but I want to talk about the 7th district, which was Nick Mosby's district. He declined to run for that seat because he ran for mayor. What's his future? I mean, one of the things that appeared to be a detriment in his campaign was the fact merely that he was married to Marilyn Mosby. And by the way, speaking of Marilyn Mosby and this consent decree, we are hopeful that Ms. Mosby will be on Midday with us on Wednesday to talk about her proposals for reform in the police department and the relationship between the police department and her office, et cetera. So stay tuned for that. But Nick Mosby, certainly a person who has the political bug. Did this election show that he may not be able to express himself
so
politically?
So if Pugh
in this
becomes
town?
Mayor, that opens her Senate seat. Right. And it's the central committee, right? Somebody has to take that seat. And that will likely open, if it's an existing member of the House of Delegates, then it's going to open another political seat, which will be... Yeah, I don't know.
Sure.
I mean, and I don't know. I mean, there's been lots of speculation about
his name
what,
has certainly been bandied about.
It has, as have
both
others.
Of those
that's correct. But that's a good question about
in
what
the grand,
happens.
In the grand scheme of things, Nick Mosby will not go away quietly. He will still be involved in this city. I have no doubts about that.
And you could see that even with last week's council meeting where he
on the
raised
issue of the, right, the
issue
zoning.
Of this council not being tough on problem liquor stores, and he gave a very passionate speech on the floor of the city council about that.
You know, we talk a lot about the new political members in Baltimore, but one of the things we haven't spoken of is that there's also room in this city for new outside leadership. And
outside leadership,
meaning nonprofit leadership, philanthropic leadership. I mean, that's very much of a status quo industry. I mean, mm-hmm. we've had the same folks for a long time. And I could see a Nick Mosby. Yeah,
Davon Love from Leaders
Absolutely.
Of a Beautiful
Very
Struggle.
Good example.
And he refers to this situation as the nonprofit industrial complex.
It is. And and it's, in many ways it is. Yeah. I'm not speaking out of school. I've actually had this conversation with that group and said, you know, but there, I can see over the next, you know, couple of years that of new people, Davon's a good example of that, of the new out, what I call outside leadership, of outside influence, which a city needs to keep it fresh, to keep leadership on its toes. I mean, that's really important.
In places like the Community Foundation with a guy like Tom Wilcox,
correct,
who is, you know, not a spring chicken, and I say
and
that
they had
lovingly.
A look, they were in a very controversial position when it was learned that they facilitated the private donation to fund that secret aerial surveillance program. I mean, I think that that was a, I think that that caught them by surprise. Mm-hmm. It's like, wait a minute.
Certainly caught people's attention.
Yes, correct.
Sure.
Right.
But in the 7th District, you got a guy, Leon Pinkett, who mm-hmm. finally won, prevailed in a very crowded race. Mm-hmm. There were 10 other people mm-hmm. running that race in the primary. He is, though, one of the guys with, one of the people in this race in all the council districts who has some modicum of experience. He's been an assistant deputy mayor.
Right.
And, you know, been a mayor's representative in the City Planning Commission. So, you know, there is going to be an interesting mix of people who've, you know, been in City Hall, at least. Mm-hmm. He knows where the, you know, where the bologna sandwiches are, you know.
And, and that's good. Exactly.
Yeah. He was on the Baltimore the BDC, the Baltimore Development Corporation, for a while, and he headed up some of the developments on the west side of Baltimore. So he is not.
Here's an email about the comptroller's race. John Bombeck has been running an aggressive campaign while incumbent Joan Pratt has been entirely absent. That's from Matthew sending in an email. What do you think about that race?
That one was a little bit of a tough one. The real contest, looking at it, took place in the primary with Joan Pratt and his name, Michael King. Joan is, I think Joan probably earned some cool points taking on the mayor over the whole telephone system, and they wound up getting some sort of compromise where she looked really good coming out of it.
And you've got these longtime ensconced incumbents like Ms. Pratt, like Council
well, that's
President
one of the
Young.
Reasons, I think I probably talked about it on this show, is that that's one of the reasons that Jack's bill, at the end of the day, failed.
Jack
is
Young,
because,
the President of the City Council.
Is because people started to realize that if we make the Board of Estimates three members, that means two of them will have been in City Hall for at least for about 20 years.
Right.
And it was like, wait a minute. And, is that really what we
And
do?
I'll say this.
Whether, the next thing.
Right.
I see no evidence that Joan Pratt is running a campaign, but in every public opinion poll I've seen, Joan Pratt does very, very well. She is well-liked and well-respected. And people, like the Baltimore City voters Facebook group, they can't understand that. They think like she's just should be thrown out, and but they don't get it. Like she, the most people in Baltimore like and respect Joan Pratt.
We just got literally a minute left. I want to talk about the so-called down ballot repercussions of the presidential campaign.
In a minute?
In a minute or less. Please explicate the following. Because you know when the letter from FBI Director Comey was sent to Congress, it's interesting to me that a lot of people thought this may not have that much implication for the presidential race, but it could affect the down ballot races. And I wonder how far down it would affect it. Like, would it affect the city council or something? And I'm sorry to give you so little time, James.
I doubt it.
What do you think?
In Baltimore City, I doubt it. I'm trying to think that where it might have some effect. I don't think in the state of Maryland, it's probably
it doesn't
not
mean a hill of
to.
Beans at this point. If you're going to vote for Trump, you're going to vote for Trump. If you're going to vote for Clinton, you're going to vote for Clinton. You're not going to think too much about the emails one way or another.
Much people splitting their voting for Trump, you know, on the top of the ticket and voting Democrat for example, Chris Van Hollen or something. That seems unlikely.
It may help in the margins a little bit for Trump. Maybe Republican support goes up a few points and Democrats go down a few points. But in Maryland, that doesn't really matter. We're 2-1.
The concern. What the issue that you're raising is that swing voters may be more likely, if they're going to vote against Trump, they may be more likely to vote against the Republican down ballot candidate to give a checks and balance if they're assuming
Congress,
Clinton's going to win. But I disagree. I do think that this has the impact to move a point or two. I really do.
Well, that's all we have time for. We will see a week from tomorrow. Jane Miller is the lead investigative reporter for WBAL Television here in Baltimore. Luke Broadwater covers politics in Baltimore City for the Baltimore Sun. Kenny Burns covers the city as the Metro reporter here at WYPR. More information about the city council races at wypr.org/midday. Thanks to The Diz for providing lunch for our guests today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a look at police training and de-escalation tactics. What are the policies concerning use of force, and should they be revised? What de-escalation strategies have been found to be effective? How can tragedies like the death of Corinne Gaines at the hands of Baltimore County Police be avoided in the future? We'll take a look at all that tomorrow on Midday at Noon, right here on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. For all of us on the Midday team, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Drive slowly and safely tonight. There will be kids aplenty out and about. Happy Halloween.